Welcome to Innovate 608, the podcast that shines a light on Wisconsin's entrepreneurial ecosystem. I'm Scott Mosley, Executive Director of Starting Block, Madison's startup hub. In this episode, I talk with Brian Pope, Chair of the UW-Madison Department of Medical Physics. Innovate 608 is made possible by the generous support of the American Family Institute for Corporate and Social Impact and our media partner, the Wisconsin State Journal. Enjoy the conversation. So Dr. Brian Pogue is the chair of the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health Department of Medical Physics. The medical physics program at the University of Wisconsin began in 1958 when a faculty member in the physics department became interested in a program in nuclear medicine and started a collaboration with the UW Department of Radiology. In 1981, a freestanding department of medical physics was created in the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. And today, the medical physics department is recognized as one of the most entrepreneurial departments on the UW campus. Brian, welcome to the Innovate 608 podcast.
Hey, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great. So before we kind of dig into your background and what brought you to Madison, let's just start with the fundamentals for people like me that really don't understand this world of what is medical physics?
Sure. Yeah. Medical, you know, the way I like to think of medical physics is it's the use of radiation in medicine. And it's physics because physicists are the ones who, you know, optimally understand how to use and control radiation. So X-ray imaging, nuclear medicine, CT scans, therapeutics like radiation therapy. So physicists are employed in every major medical center to make sure that the radiation is being used appropriately. And then it extends beyond that. There's things like ultrasound and MRI and surgical guidance, where basically medical physicists are kind of like biomedical engineers, but they're employed by the hospital to control and use big technology.
So as we kind of go back into your background a little bit, you did your undergraduate degree at McMaster in Hamilton, Ontario, and then you went to York for your master's and back to McMaster for your PhD in physics. What was that trajectory like?
So I came from the Toronto area and, you know, I, like many people who wind up in medical physics, I just wanted to do physics. I just loved doing physics. But then as you go on in life, you realize you actually have to do something that matters. And so I then discovered medical physics as a subspecialty. And like many people who enter the field, I just really wanted to do something that kind of touched on people and helped people more than just sort of playing with physics. And so medical physics just seemed purposeful, and much like engineering is, you can actually do something that matters.
And so when you were, you know, going through all of this education, was there a point in that where you said to yourself, you know, it's not just about the basic and fundamental research, it's about building tools and tools lead to companies. Did that ever cross your mind? Was that ever part of your educational training?
Interestingly, completely not. Like there was no education whatsoever about turning research into devices or purposeful things. But that came a little later when I did a postdoc in Boston, and then when I was at Dartmouth, and I became immersed in working with companies. And then the more you work with companies, you realize, you know, as a basic researcher, you can't affect the world unless you actually make something that is produced, and it's got to be done in a compliant way and all that stuff. And so, you know, the natural realization that a startup is the way to pathway to do that is it sort of evolved in my mind.
Well, let's talk about your time at Dartmouth. You were adjunct professor of surgery in the medical school. How does that kind of appointment work? Because you're not a medical doctor.
That's right. Yeah. So it's actually pretty common in major medical centers that they'll give adjunct faculty or affiliate faculty appointments to PhDs in engineering or physics. And so that was I was employed by the engineering school, but I got this honorary, if you will, appointment in surgery. And so I would talk to surgeons about ideas, and we worked on, I probably was involved in startup or thinking of startup of about 3 to 4 different companies over the years. But as you know, startups often fail,
right?
And so some of those worked and some did not.
So how do you translate that? I mean, you know, I think a lot of us think about the work that academics do at large research institutions as just basic and fundamental research, trying for discovery. But it sounds like your pathway was different, that there was a lot of practical implication, practical engagement with end users.
I would say yes and no. Okay. I still firmly believe that you can do invention and discovery hand in hand with translation and development. I firmly believe that they're actually partners. Like, you can't really form a fundamentally new company about an exciting product unless there was an invention, you know? And that invention came from some kind of basic research. And so I actually fully support this idea that we need both invention and discovery on one hand, and then translation and startup and entrepreneurship on the other hand.
And so how did you see that come to pass at Dartmouth? What was that environment like?
Yeah, Dartmouth was great because I was at the engineering school, and right across the street was the business school. And, you know, they had a culture of startup companies and fostering them. And they even started various entrepreneurship programs. And so, again, I was, I wouldn't say it was always on my mind, but it was always there. The idea that if something really cool came along and you had patented it and it was unique, that you could translate that into a product in a company. And so that environment was ripe. And, you know, I wouldn't say obsessed over it. I wouldn't even pay that much attention to it until I felt like there was something truly unique. I'm not, my threshold now for patenting things is, are you going to build a company around it? Because, you know, as a researcher, I feel like I could file a patent disclosure every week if I wanted to, you know, but then you would just waste all your time filing patent disclosures,
right?
So you really want to make sure it matters, right?
But I mean, I think that's an interesting juxtaposition, right? Because, you know, as a tenure track faculty, that's what you're employed to do,
yep,
in a lot of cases, is to generate intellectual property that provide, you know, future revenue streams for the university.
True.
So the fact that you say, you know, you could do that every week, wouldn't that be the natural extension of your work?
It should be. But again, you know, we live in a world that's just swimming in patents, right? And so how many overlapping patents are there on any given topic? There's a lot. And really, a patent is just a license to sue somebody, or, you know, and so it really just depends on how much money in the bank you've got. So I, as a researcher, I really restrict my patent disclosure ideas to areas that I think are fundamentally new.
Mm-hmm.
So that I know that there's sort of no, or there's clean prior art, if you will, mm-hmm, in that space. Because if it's really conflicted and there's hundreds of other patents in that space, and I'm just got some little widget version improvement of that, I just don't, as a researcher, I just don't get excited about that. I'm not interested in that pursuit.
But I think it's interesting that you then juxtapose that to say, if I do file, my intention is to build around that.
Right. Because that's, for me, that's just a good acid test of how important is it. Because again, I don't have enough time in the day to file patent disclosure every week.
Right.
You know, it would just take all my time, you know, so I really want to make sure I focus on things that matter.
So when you think about your time at Dartmouth, what did that look like in terms of working with postdocs and you know, others in the department to take that research out of the department and turn that into companies? What was the atmosphere like?
Yeah, actually, that's a great question. So probably the most impactful thing I was ever involved with at Dartmouth is we took the biomedical engineering department and moved it into the hospital.
Mm.
So we actually bought a floor of the research building in the hospital. And that's so critically important because, you know, as a business person, being embedded with your customer is right, about the best situation you could ever imagine, right? So we embedded ourselves with our customer, the physicians are our customer. And so we could have daily and weekly meetings with surgeons, and we literally did, on ideas, and we could rapidly iterate on, okay, this, because a lot of things don't work, right?
Right.
And so you have to fail fast and then move on to the next idea. And so it just allowed us to do a lot of rapid iteration. So being physically in the medical center for an engineer was just kind of a dream come true. And that environment was one of the best situations that I was involved with.
And so when we think about that kind of time period, the 15 years you were at Dartmouth, how was that funded? Was that you know, university funding that was supporting that work? Was that NIH funding? Was that NSF funding? Where were you getting the money to make those collaborative partnerships?
That was almost entirely NIH funded. I'm a grant writer. You know, I like coming up with ideas, and I like writing grants, mm-hmm, around them. I know a lot of people are frustrated by it and don't like writing grants. I'm sort of addicted to it. I like it because I find it's an outlet for creativity. Mm. Again, I still believe that good ideas get funded. You know, that's not always true, but good ideas do get funded. And so I think that is the pathway that is the strongest in this country. In biomedical space, it's well known that NIH funds good research on average, not always, but on average. And so for me, always been NIH funded. And then as time went on, I got more involved with companies, and then things shifted a little bit.
So, you know, at a similar time, we saw a lot of movement by NSF and then ultimately NIH, DOE, other agencies picking up the I-Corps model. Mm-hmm. Was that, I mean, the language you just used about rapid iteration, about customer discovery, about being embedded with your customer, though that's not language that we typically hear academics use.
Right. Yeah. That's my, I guess, business translation of what I think of. But I do think that the job of a biomedical engineer or medical physicist is to invent things that matter to physicians, mm-hmm. right? And again, they're our customers. So I've kind of adopted that language, I guess, in my academic world. And I think it's important. You know, I'm a big advocate of the startup culture around academia and making sure that they are synergistic with each other.
Mm. So one of the companies that you got involved with in 2015 was a startup called Dose Optics. Can you tell us a little bit about that experience?
Yeah, Dose Optics was from technology that we developed and that I patented from our lab. And it's a way to image radiation dose in radiotherapy. So when the radiation beam hits a patient, we have these cameras that pick up a little signal and we can actually image it in real time. And it's truly unique. We patented it. There's no other patents anywhere in that space. And so and that happened back in 2010, 2011. Mm-hmm. And then it wasn't until 2015 that I started the company because I found somebody who was willing to be the CEO.
And that was not a role you wanted to take.
Yeah, no, that's my first word of advice to any scientist is you should not be the CEO. You have need to, the scientist is the good CSO or CTO, right? But they should not even try to be the CEO. Unless they're really good at that, I'm not good at business, so it's not my thing. So I happened to find the CEO, and it's been wonderful ever since.
And so let's talk about that kind of experience over those, you know, couple of years. You discovered technology, you file for patents, you say, okay, this is a potential for a company. We're going to recruit people to run this. What is that recruiting? I mean, obviously the CEO, you know, you've gone outside of the hospital system to do that outside of the department. But what about, you know, who else from your inner circle there was involved in the company?
Yeah. And very obviously, like many startups, it was kind of my inner circle who started the company, really. I would say a former postdoc, a former graduate student, and then the CEO, and then another former postdoc. And we were sort of the five, I would say, that started the core team. And then I pulled in several Dartmouth undergrads to work in summer internships and things. And you know, you have to basically hire one person at a time, and every hire matters. And, you know, gradually we sort of built out the expertise. We had to find a few people, like a regulatory person. We had no regulatory people. We had to find somebody a little bit outside, but we were lucky to find somebody in the local area, and then consultants for things that we just don't have expertise on. And as you know, the strategic use of consultants is critical for startup companies.
So when I think about that as a model, I mean, I find that to be interesting that, you know, you have multiple postdocs in your inner circle who are at least willing to take a chance on a startup that perhaps academia is not the road they want to walk down. How do you reconcile that with, again, you know, the kind of the pre-existing thought that as tenured faculty, your role is to produce additional research and graduate more students?
Yeah. Well, you know, again, I think that people are opportunistic, right? And you're constantly judging, where's my best opportunity? And so for many of those people involved, they were 50-50. Actually, they stayed at the university 50% and they worked at the company 50%. So it's a way of hedging your bets, if you will, right? You can, if the company fails, you can go back to the university.
Right.
And vice versa. If the company succeeds, you can jettison the university and go on and
right.
and do something exciting. I think both are good, and everybody makes decisions about what their best opportunity is at the time. Yeah. Most of the people at the company were part-time early on.
Sure.
And just to, again, because you're kind of cash starved. And so we made it work with part-time people. And then gradually there's more and more people full-time now.
So you were at Dartmouth for well over 15 years. When you think about Dartmouth and UW-Madison, those are really different institutions. And Dartmouth's 6,500 total students. UW-Madison's 55,000. What brought you here?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, for me, it's just an explosion of opportunity coming here. I mean, that's the reason I'm here is people in our department who had a long history of starting companies were some of the people who, you know, I was most excited about to come work with. And people like Rock Mackey and even our founder, John Cameron, decades ago, you know, were starting companies in medical physics. And so the reputation of this place, especially in medical physics around startup companies, is almost unparalleled in our field. I think we've counted now 26 startup companies coming out of the department. And when I do a tally of the current faculty, about one third of them have a startup company on the side, highest number in all of UW, you know. And so just the opportunity to jump into that giant, you know, pool of entrepreneurship and academics too, and do something special was just too much for me. I was just overjoyed to come.
You were saying that the department has one of the highest ratios of faculty startup founders on the UW campus, that there is a rich history of startups and entrepreneurship coming out of the department. What do you think that's attributable to?
Yeah, I think it's an artifact of some of the things I mentioned before. If you're embedded with your customer, you can come up with great ideas that help solve problems. And so the medical physicists have always been embedded in the hospital. And, you know, radiation oncologists and radiologists are coming up with issues that need to be solved. And so they solve them. And then once you've solved them, you realize, well, I've solved it, but actually hasn't translated to the rest of the world. And so the natural step then is to start a company and turn it, spin it into a product. And so I can see, you know, going back to the founders of the department, they've been doing that for 40 years ago. And then now many more faculty in the department are doing it today.
But I think that's, you know, that's interesting because when we look across other departments and other places in the university, you know, I think a lot of people would argue that they are embedded with customers or potential users, but yet the production level of the medical physics department seems to stand out.
Yep.
Why would the culture, I mean, what part of that culture enables that, allows that to happen?
Well, I think, you know, medical physicists are very similar to engineers, basically. But, you know, engineers are stuck in the engineering school and they're not embedded with their customer. They're, you know, in their engineering building. So I like to think of us as like a fantastic biomedical engineering division that just is lucky enough to be constantly working day to day with our customer. So that really intimate level of embeddedness is really unique in medical physics. And then, you know, part of it also is this university had the foresight to create a large department of medical physics. Not all, in fact, very few universities have the kind of scale of medical physics we have here. You know, we have, I think we graduate something like 20% of all medical physicists in the United States.
Wow.
That just gives you a perspective on how big this program is, and very unique.
And so when you think about program design, you think about the output of students into the, you know, future faculty, future researchers, future discovery. How does that experience around entrepreneurship, both of your own and of the departments, how does that influence decisions that you're making about student experience?
Yeah, I want the students to be exposed to entrepreneurship. But as you know, it's tricky. There's no roadmap. There's no guidebook to entrepreneurship, right? So most of our students, I would say, are focused on being a clinical medical physicist in a hospital or cancer center. And I think that's great. But along the way, I want them to be exposed to all the sort of sphere of things that they could do. They could be a faculty. They could be work in industry for GE Healthcare. They could start a company. And so we are embedding some experiences and programming in the department around entrepreneurship, for example, specifically, so that they can, you know, take advantage of this incredible sphere of startup culture around here, because they could get a job. You know, maybe they really like Madison,
right?
And instead of going to work in Buffalo,
right,
they could actually just get a job here and work for a startup company. And, you know, again, every person has to make that decision for themselves, but if it's the right startup company, it's a great opportunity.
So how do you give people the experience to both step into a CSO CTO role and to be a founder? Is that part of your thinking?
Yeah. So we, you know, to be a founder, you have to be in on the origination of the company. And so we have started an entrepreneurship fellowship program. So we have a competition every year. We've just gone through one cycle, but we have a competition to apply. And for the best candidate, we have a board that helps pick them. And then we fund them to incubate their company. So they have 2 years of funding to run with their idea, go through all the training programs with WARF and with the D2P and with the Isthmus Project and other entities on campus to kind of really take their company, run with it, find their CEO, find their partners, and make it a real entity. And that's the way to turn, you know, smart PhD students into founders of companies. And I think, you know, time will tell, but I think that program is going to give a great experience for those people who go through it. But beyond that, you know, this campus is, the campus UW is just awash in opportunities for learning how to start a company, from the boot camp that's run on campus from the business school all the way to, you know, the D2P programs and the WARF programs.
So you mentioned the Isthmus Project. That's a relatively new campus project, I guess, to work between UW Health and the School of Medicine. So what's your relationship then with Isthmus, and how does that lead to new potential technology and new potential company?
Yeah, a great question. I'm pretty new here, so I don't fully know, but I am just appointed to the board of the Isthmus Project. So in the future, I'll have a better view of how to make that work. But obviously, the med school and UW Health are partners in everything in healthcare and research. And so we should be working together. And I think in my mind, it's just making sure we're coordinated and really pick the best people to help push them forward to run with their companies and their technology.
Great. So when we think about the broader ecosystem here in the Madison area in Wisconsin, and we have obviously UW Health, we have other institutions, you know, Marshfield Clinic, we have the medical school or the medical college in Milwaukee. Do you see collaboration across those entities, or is that something that's aspirational?
I think there can. There's no barriers. It's really just supporting companies that want to found and looking for to help people form their team. You know, the team of a company is everything, right? So we'll be, you know, scrounging to help find partners anywhere that's successful. Again, I haven't put a lot of thought into it, but in general, you know, there's no boundaries, no walls. We just want to help bring everybody up and show people the pathway to forming companies. And again, you know, one of the reasons I'm so passionate about this in the big graduate program we have is, you know, the pathway to be a clinical physicist is very clear.
Right.
It's paved. I call it the yellow brick road. They just follow the yellow brick road and you get this wonderful job at the end. Right. But being an entrepreneur is like walking through a jungle. You know, there's not even a path to follow. There's no, you have to cut your own path, right? And you have to find your own way. And so equipping people with just the tools and the vision to sort of cut their way through that jungle is one of the things that I'm passionate about. But getting back to the question, I don't see any issue with collaborating with anybody in the whole Wisconsin area that wants to be involved. I mean, we're very open to that.
That's great. What national, federal level resources that do you guys bring on campus or affiliate with that would allow both faculty and students to walk down this road?
Yeah. Well, there's lots of government programs, obviously, NSF, NIH. I'm a grant writer by heart, so mm-hmm. writing SBIR grants is something I've done over and over and over again. I think I've probably been involved in somewhere between 20 and 25 SBIR grants. It's free money.
Right.
You know, so, you know, the company I'm involved with, we now have $10 million of free money from the government. You know, I mean, it's the American dream. You $10 million to start your company. Not everybody's going to get that, but it's not too hard to get $400,000, and then it's not too hard to get your first phase two if it's a good idea. So I'm a strong advocate of, applying to the SBIR program. I think that's kind of step one for many mm-hmm. companies. And to do that, they need to be able to show that they have the infrastructure and facilities. So places like Innovate here and are great opportunities for people, and finding the partners to build the team. And then, being aware of all the government opportunities, I think, are critical.
So when you look back at your time at Dartmouth and you think about the ecosystem that was surrounding the facilities there and kind of in that New England area, how does that differ from what you see here in Madison?
Well, you know, they're very different. Dartmouth is in the middle, it's just a very small place in the middle of New Hampshire, Vermont, with nobody around. Yeah. or very few people. Right. Madison is this giant, thriving ecosystem of people, which is incredible. And the opportunity here for space, for people, for collaborations, for helping each other is phenomenal. I can't imagine a better place. Again, in the medical physics world, it's honestly probably the best city in the country to start a company. Maybe California competes a little bit, but not, sure. We have expertise base here, which is very strong. The size scale is probably the biggest one,
okay.
But also the culture, you know, with Wharf and with the history of companies and Epic being here, of course, and other things, there is a thriving ecosystem of startups. And the other thing you need is people who are willing to shift companies too, and enough bolus of people that a company can fail and people don't feel bad and have to move their family, move away. And at Dartmouth, that was a real problem. I mean, there was nobody to hire. The only way we could get people who had any experience was to hire them from Boston.
Sure.
And they would have to move 2 hours away. So from here, it's like asking people from Chicago to move up, you know, and it's a tough sell unless there's lots of other companies around as a safety net. So this place has the safety net. It's got the thriving ecosystem, and it's a cool place to live too.
Great. When you think about faculty that are interested in walking down the road you've walked down, what's the one piece of advice you would say? What's the one thing you would offer that would perhaps make that journey a little bit easier?
Yeah, I say a couple things, like find your CEO,
right.
Because I firmly believe if somebody's going to stay an academic, they shouldn't try to be the CEO, because that means they're not really a business person. They could be the CSO or the CTO. And then you got to build out the team, find the money. And to me, the shortest path is SBIRs or, you know, angel funds or things are great, but it takes more time.
Right.
Make sure it's something you really want to spend your life doing. And, you know, so to me, it's got to be a mixture of scientifically interesting and beneficial to people. And those two things are really and it's got to be patentable.
Right.
So, you know, if that magically all comes together, then there should be a company there. And, you got to make sure you're willing to put the hours in too, because it's not like, you invent free time, you know, it just means you're going to do it on weekends and evenings.
Right. So. Right. So if there was one thing that you could add to the ecosystem here, what would that be?
Well, I'm hoping that I can convince some of our medical physicists to dive into the entrepreneurial activity. I'm hoping that we can work with existing companies here that to think about synergizing with the university in a little more mature way, more premeditated way, I should say. And I know that there are future companies budding here. And so I just want to help them launch. I want to help sort of reduce the energy barrier, if you will, for making that happen.
Great. Well, thanks for taking the time to come down and talk to us today.
Thanks, Scott. It was a pleasure.
Yeah. So we've been talking to Brian Pogue, who is the chair of the UW School of Medicine's Department of Medical Physics.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Starting Blocks Innovate 608. You can hear more episodes about Wisconsin's entrepreneurial ecosystem on the Starting Block website at startingblockmadison.org or on your favorite podcast platform.